Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. Today is Wednesday, December 13th. I'm Stephen Overly. The European Union has a bunch of new AI rules coming out over the next 2 years. Take police departments. Soon, they'll be able to use facial recognition technology to investigate cases of terrorism or kidnapping, but be banned from using AI to predict whether people might commit crimes. The restrictions are laid out in the EU AI Act, new legislation that puts the EU ahead of most other governments around the world in trying to put limits on powerful AI systems. But hammering out the final terms of that law was a long and often tense process. Dragos Todorake is one of two EU parliamentarians leading the charge on AI regulation and had a seat at the head of that negotiating table.
Sometimes it's not a pretty sight because sometimes the clash, the tension is real. And we had real moments of tension and clash during these negotiations.
I spoke with Todorake a couple of months ago as these negotiations were just getting underway. And now that the deal is done, I called him up again to get him to take me inside the negotiating room. The EU is taking a victory lap for finishing this big AI legislation, something the US and other countries really have not been able to do yet. How did you get this across the finish line?
Well, I think mostly with the shared understanding of all the people around the table, and that does not only mean us as the negotiating team of the European Parliament, but also the Council and the Commission, that this was something that we simply could not afford to fail on. In fact, this is what I think kept us awake during the first 23-hour marathon, then followed by another 17-hour marathon. And that pretty much was what pushed it over the line. And of course, an effort that we all made to find compromise, to hear each other out, to listen to arguments, to try and impose arguments at times, because this is how negotiations go. But again, if it hadn't been for the sense of purpose and urgency on all sides, I think because there were many, I think all of us, almost in parallel, we were all receiving messages from different colleagues saying, well, maybe you could take another trilogue and you could take another trilogue. What's the rush at the end of the day? We can still do it next year. And it would have been easy to fall into that trap of waiting or postponing. But again, I think we all wanted to see this done because we all thought it was important to do it now. And I'm happy that prevailed.
And you mentioned that sort of sprint there at the end where you had these, I guess, it was sort of a marathon and a sprint, right? You had these marathon sessions of negotiations at the end. Can you put me in the room? What was that like?
Well, I think some of these negotiations are better left where they are in the room. It's like sometimes it's better not to see what happens in the kitchen, but actually enjoy the meal. In a way, it's the same here. It's certainly not. Sometimes it's interesting to see, but sometimes it's not a pretty sight because sometimes the clash, the tension is real. And we had real moments of tension and clash during these negotiations. But what's important is that at the end, you shake hands and you reach a deal. And we managed to do that. So yes, if someone wants to know whether we had difficult moments, yes, we did. And we had breakout sessions. We had hours of waiting for each other to do our own separate deliberations on different points that we put on the table. Even within each other's respective constituencies, in a way, it wasn't easy, both on our side as well as for the council, checking back with capitals on various points. But again, in files that are as important as this one, it's normal, it's natural. I think it would be completely naive to believe that it is all easy sailing. So for me, I was not surprised by the tense moments and also by the intensity of the debate sometimes. I didn't really expect that it would be ending up negotiating for 40 hours, but we did. But we had to do what we had to do.
I hear you that some things are best left in the room. I know policymaking is often messier than people present it to be. Can you elaborate on just one of those tension points and how you worked it out?
Well, I think it's no secret that we went in with two big battles ahead of us. And we all knew that we would actually be having those clashes. One of them was on the regime for foundation models. And the other one was on the whole bubble the whole cluster on security and law enforcement access to certain AI tools. The agenda was actually quite rich, 20-something points. So there were other elements, but those were agreed rather easily. And then, true to expectation, we then remain with the two big points, each of them that took a good share of the 40 hours of negotiations. On foundation models, the big discussion was not necessarily, it wasn't necessarily a political or ideological debate, as much as it was one of finding the right place to put the cursor in between over-regulating and under-regulating, and also finding the right criteria to determine what would be those, let's call them top-tier models that would get heavier regulation, and also those that would be in the down tier. And also, what is the right amount of responsibility for those ones? And also, very importantly, not only the content of the obligations on the top tier, but how to play out those obligations, understanding that with the novelty of this technology, there aren't any standards yet, and neither would they be for an immediate future in terms of how to measure those obligations. And this is where we discussed a lot on the issue of the code of practice, which some perceive as self-regulation, but it's not fully self-regulation because the obligations are still fixed in law. It is how you implement those obligations where we eventually agree that there needs to be a degree of co-generation between the companies developing those models and the future EU regulator. So we did end up with a code of practice as a tool to ensure enforcement as an interim solution until standards would be developed. So finding all this architecture with the tiers, with the criteria to determine the tiers, with the obligations for the top tier, the obligations for the top for the top tier, the role of the code of practices, how they would interplay. So all of that architecture was certainly not easy to articulate, and we've had a lot of going and forth and back on that between us in the negotiations. And then on the other one, that was more ideological in nature, because it had to do with a balance between the need to ensure security, but also protecting privacy. Which is never an easy debate. And some of the tools are going at the heart of this debate. Public surveillance using such a sophisticated technology as AI goes to the heart of that debate. How much can you allow that to happen if you also want to protect your privacy and the privacy of individuals? But also how do you also ensure that your law enforcement, which you also want to have the tools to fight crime and to ensure the security of citizens, how to ensure that they have the right access. So again, there was a lot of debate on that. And because also it's the more legalistic part of the text, because you're playing with concepts that would be interpreted by courts and law enforcement agencies, also the formulations need to be very carefully crafted. So there was a triple debate, a very political one, then a technical one, and also a very legal one, and that made it the most difficult part of the text that we discussed last week.
I want to ask you about what's in the actual act that's now been finalized, and you mentioned two key issues I wanted to touch on. Let's start with AI and law enforcement, particularly facial recognition, because I know that was a point of contention when the negotiations started, and the new law seems to have reached a compromise there, that some uses would be banned or limited, but not others. What are the new rules going to be?
So what we ended up with for the facial recognition in public spaces is a lot more than what the commission initially had in its initial proposal. So if you remember, we in Parliament had moved from the initial proposal of the commission all the way to putting an outright ban. So basically no exceptions for the use of this technology in public spaces. And then the council, who wanted to have an exception for law enforcement because of the interest to use the technology in certain cases. And once we had made this parliament the concession of saying, okay, we are open to discuss the idea of an exception for law enforcement, which was a major concession for us politically, but then we wanted to see this exception accompanied by much stronger set of safeguards than what the commission had initially proposed. And I'll give you one example. In the initial commission proposal, there was talk of prevention. So prevention of crime was a situation, a context in which you could actually use the exception for law enforcement. For us, prevention of crime would have been too much of a blank check in terms of basically inviting more or less the deployment of these technologies all the time. Because you could say, well, who knows, maybe in front of my house, there'll be a criminal passing by in the next 10 minutes. So in order to prevent crime, I might as well turn on the machine and keep it on all the time. So in a way, the risk, the temptation for abuse in certain member states, again, I'm not doing a process of intent against anyone, but again, the possibility for abuse, the temptation for abuse would have been too present if we were to simply refer to generic prevention of crime as a criteria. So again, we've worked with very strict contexts in which, and this is what we now have, a very strictly defined context. It has to be an imminent threat to life. It has to be an imminent threat to a present and or foreseeable threat of terrorism. It has to be well within the criminal investigation. It has to come with very strict oversight, only with judicial authorization or an independent body, as described by the ECJ jurisprudence, that can take binding decisions. Again, the set of safeguards that we have added to it is very strict to make sure that if it is to be used by law enforcement in those exceptional circumstances, it is done with sufficient control from independent bodies. There is also an oversight at the level of the DPAs, the data protection authorities. So again, we've done all the checks and balances that we could think of to make sure that this exception is not opening up a loophole when it comes to the rights of citizens. And I think the balance that we eventually found is the right one.
We'll be right back. The other issue I wanted to ask, which you've mentioned on already, is these obligations that will be placed on the creators of these top tier or frontier, you know, high risk AI models, a lot of which, you know, a lot of these creators, by the way, are US based companies. What obligations will they have under the new act?
Some of them have to do with documentation and transparency, let's say. A bit more transparent. So transparency is also for the low tier, but it's what I would say transparency with a twist, i.e. additional documentation that you'd have to do. Then it's testing and red teaming. So basically you have to engage in testing different scenarios of risk and also be open to outside independent retesting and red teaming of those scenarios of risk, because that is something that ensures that you are really covering all possible angles, all possible risks that might come out of the use or the deployment of that model. There are also, and this is quite, I think, important, there are obligations linked to ensuring energy efficiency in the way you train and you develop and you design these algorithms, which is something that that speaks of the sustainability angle for the development and the deployment of models. There are also obligations that are linked to copyright, so obligations towards the copyright holders, and that is linked to the transparency that we believe models like this owe to those that hold copyright. We're not adding to the copyright legislation, but we're simply fleshing out this obligation. Through this obligation of transparency, we're fleshing out that material so that afterwards right holders can properly and duly exercise those rights. And then the whole interaction with the regulator, and this is where the codes of practice also intervene, because we believe that models in that top tier, they have to be prepared to engage with the future market regulator at European level to make sure that if there are incidents, that they are properly reported to the regulator, that the risk mitigating measures that they've put in place are duly monitored, accounted for, and part of the enforcement that the future regulator will do. So this dialogue, constant dialogue that will have to be maintained between the developers of these models and the future regulator. And if I'm to draw a parallel, this is not very far an approach from the one that is also covered in the executive order on the US side, which is also for the let's call it top tier, for those that are above the 2026 FLOPS criteria in terms of compute power, they also have a similar obligations of interaction with the regulators, with the sectoral regulators on their side, also to that, to the same end of mitigating risks and engaging in proper monitoring of risks as they might occur.
How aligned do you see the EU Act ultimately with the executive order that the Biden administration has put out? I mean, are the US and EU headed down different paths here when it comes to regulating this technology?
Certainly, you can't draw comparison between our act is a piece of legislation to start with, and quite comprehensive in covering all type of risks, from no risk to low risk to high risk to prohibitions and then a special regime for foundation models. And the executive order is a different kind of an instrument. But if you unpack somewhat the logic behind, the rationale and some of the objectives that are meant to be achieved, that's where you find actually there are a lot of similarities. In other words, the starting point is the same. Recognizing the same kind of risks, recognizing the same kind of context in deploying technology and where they might interact with the rights of individuals or the interests of society. So if you look in executive order, the kind of areas that are being identified and where work is being required, they are not at all different from the areas that also the EU Act identifies either as areas of high risk or of medium and low risk and so on and so forth. So again, the basis, I would say, is the same. The solutions are different. The AI Act goes down the path of saying, listen, these safeguards are necessary and we want to enforce them. Because we believe that only via voluntary compliance, we're not going to achieve what we want to achieve. Looking also at past experiences with social media platforms and their code of conduct, which hasn't really meant much in terms of what the social media platform's behavior was after the code of conduct a couple of years ago. So again, we chose by looking at that same picture, looking at that same basis, we chose to say, these need to be, at least some of them, some of these concerns and risks need to be regulated. They need to be accompanied by clear safeguards. Whereas on the US side, but I would dare say also because of lack of action on the side of the legislator, I think the White House did the most that they could do in terms of the instruments at its disposal via the executive order, to at least nudge in the direction of saying some accountability is needed, we need to look into the risks. They gave a mandate to various federal agencies to start working actively in those respective sectors to be identifying those risks and try and mitigate them as much as possible through softer measures, such as, for example, federal contracting. So federal contracting on AI would have to be respectful of voluntary commitments and so forth. So again, I think that it does. It intends almost very similar things like we, but it just addresses them with different tools simply because they were the only ones available. And when it comes to the foundation models and the approach to the possible systemic risks that come from these models, I think the approach is not very dissimilar. Again, ours is more elaborate, but I think the net effect might be the same.
The EU announced a political deal this past Friday that, you know, discussions were wrapped on the negotiations, but discussions over the actual text, I understand, are still happening this week, still expected to kind of continue. What still needs to be settled here?
Well, in 48 hours of negotiating 24 different points on the agenda, clearly there's now a lot of alignment and recovery that needs to be done because each of the three institutions were putting different solutions of text on the table. Then we were agreeing on the text, but one of them was left on the Commission's laptop. The other one was left on the Council's laptop. The other one was left on our laptops and so on and so forth. So first of all, there's simply a mechanical gathering exercise that now needs to happen to bring all of the agreements on all of the 24 points on the agenda during the 40 hours together. Then you might, in works like this, it's almost inevitable that you find some inconsistencies because what you agreed under point 5 of the agenda at 12 o'clock at night might all of a sudden not be fully aligned with what you agreed on another point of the agenda at 6 o'clock in the morning. This is why it's going to take a few days before a final text would actually be available. We expect it as well. We want it as well. But we understand that it certainly won't need the time that it did for the Data Act or for the EID, where they took months to actually arrive after technical work to a final version of the text to come for vote. And then there's a mandatory phase which comes in anyway, where the lawyer linguists in both institutions, they come together and they do a complete sweep of the text to make sure that, again, from a legal and legalistic point of view, there's no inconsistency, no bad referencing of treaty articles or other legislation or things like that in the text, before you can say, voila, this is the final text. Now, this is what goes for final vote and what the world sees. So I know there's a lot of expectation out there and everyone wants to see the final text, but I'm afraid it will take a little time before that is possible.
Everyone does want to see that text. I certainly want to see that text. You know, I know once that is finalized, you know, this law doesn't fully take effect until 2025. A lot can change in that time, you know, especially given the pace of AI's development. What's the rule book until then?
The rule book is status quo. So until the law comes into effect, basically doesn't exist theoretically. But again, if I would be a company that is working in developing AI or marketing AI or deploying AI or using AI, I would start looking once, of course, the text is available and adopted and it gets the final vote in council and parliament, which most realistically will happen sometime in February. I think from that moment onwards, even if it is not yet applicable, that is law. There's no way around it. So from the point of view of someone who is potentially subject of that law, as of February, I would very seriously roll up my sleeve and just look to see, is this applicable to me or not? In other words, am I at all in the scope of this law? Am I possibly in any of the risk categories or not? If the answer is not, then I don't have to do anything. I'll just have to continue doing what I do. But if somehow I would see that I might come under one of the categories of risk because the AI that I work with or I work on is either listed in one of the categories in the annex or it is a model that comes under the foundation model regime, then I should voluntarily at the beginning until the law kicks in, I should start preparing for possible compliance. And the commission will put some incentives for that. Others who don't want to use that incentive would do their own assessments and prepare separately for compliance. But I would not leave this period if I would be, again, a company working on AI. I would not leave this period blank. I would ask myself the key questions already now.
Excellent. Well, I know there's still work to be done, even after all these marathon negotiations, but thank you for joining us on Politico Tech.
You're very welcome.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our senior producer is Annie Reese. Our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.